I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The terrible toll of opioid addiction is often the top story when it comes to illegal drug use in this country. While that gets all the attention, another pharmaceutical well known in these parts has increased production and distribution. The methamphetamine epidemic is worse now than it was in the 90s, but it's also taking a very different form. Today, we'll find out what is being done to curb its distribution and get help for those addicted to meth. Later, a conversation on the options for senior living. Not everyone wants to or can handle living without help in their current homes. So what options do they have? We'll find out as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Missouri has a meth problem. Actually, the whole country has a problem with addiction to methamphetamines, chronicled in TV dramas and from time to time in reports of neighborhood drug seizures or overdose deaths. But Jackson County, especially Independence, was once called in a Rolling Stone article, the meth capital of America. There is still a problem with meth in our region today, but it's changed a lot over the years. There's still a real threat from the drug, but it's different than you might think. KCUR health reporter Alex Smith has been covering this issue, and he joins us this morning. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Brian.
We're also joined by Eric Smith, no relation. He works in the DEA's Kansas City office as the assistant special agent in charge. And Eric, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Susan Whitmore is president and CEO of First Call. Good morning, Susan.
Thank you.
First Call addresses drug addiction and treatment in the area, and we'll get to that in a moment. But Alex, let me start with where the meth in our region is coming from. When I think of meth in Missouri, the image in my head is of meth labs in people's homes, maybe in a shed out behind the building. That's not really an accurate picture these days, is it?
That's right. I mean, when I grew up in Kansas City, and I remember very well in the 90s and the early 2000s, just hearing a lot about, you know, meth in Jackson County and just what a big problem it is. And, you know, it's easy to forget just, you know, what a significant problem that was in Jackson County. I mean, there was years where they were busting a meth lab every 2 or 3 days. And now that has largely disappeared. I mean, the meth in meth labs in Jackson County are just, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of what they once were. But as it turns out, there is more meth in Jackson County, or at least in our area, than there ever has been.
Which seems counterintuitive. So where's it coming from?
Well, I think Agent Smith can probably fill us in a little bit better on that than I can. But as I understand, rather than being produced right here, you know, in Jackson County in our own area, the vast majority of meth that we're seeing is actually imported from Mexico.
Well, let's ask Agent Eric Smith about that. I mean, it's coming from Mexico. Who's trafficking in meth these days?
Well, it originates with the Mexican drug cartels, the same cartels in the 80s and 90s that were notorious for trafficking in cocaine and marijuana, stepped in to fill the supply void that the meth addiction of the late 90s and early 2000s created, when legislation in Kansas and Missouri and many other states limited the access to precursor chemicals used by local residents and local citizens to cook meth in their own backyards.
Precursor chemicals like
pseudoephedrine.
Things you buy at the pharmacy.
Iodine, lithium batteries, things that could be purchased over the counter in a Walmart or a Walgreens or a hardware store were used at that time to make a much lower quality and less potent methamphetamine. When those restrictions were enacted, it dried up the supply, but of course the Mexican drug trafficking cartels recognized that void and moved very quickly to fill it.
And how long did that shift take? I mean, what years are we talking about? Alex remembers growing up here and hearing about the meth lab raids that were reported in the news. When did this shift happen?
So in about 2003, when I was a young agent in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we were still seeing what was then called 3.2 meth. It was a reference to light beer.
Oh, okay.
So
like near beer.
3.2 meth was produced locally and had low potency, low quality. So probably about 5 years after that, about 2008, 2009, the Mexican drug trafficking cartels really ramped up their production and started shipping methamphetamine of a more significant quality but not near to the purity and quality that we're seeing today.
So, and the implications of this purer quality meth that we're seeing today is what?
Well, they're twofold. Number one, it's more readily available, and number two, it's cheaper. That's a terrible combination.
Alex, Eric Smith is a federal agent. You spoke, I know, for a recent story with an undercover cop who worked on the Jackson County Drug Task Force, local law enforcement. What kind of impact did their work have?
Oh, that's right. Well, Jackson County, from everything I've seen, really, you know, was ahead of the curve in just working to limit the sale of pseudoephedrine and just some of the precursor elements that Agent Smith was talking about. And so, actually, meth labs in Jackson County peaked in 2001, which was really far before that happened in Missouri. I mean, in fact, in a lot of counties near St. Louis and in Springfield, I mean, you didn't see the peak of meth labs until 2011 or 2012. So, I mean, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what happened, but it does appear that, you know, we were able to really, address that, you know, far ahead of a lot of other parts of Missouri.
And Agent Smith, this purer form, this more intense form of meth comes here from Mexico. It still has to be converted somehow for use. Is that happening here in Missouri?
It depends on the smuggling method. Two things to address your question. In order to convert it for use, if it arrives here in its solid form, it really simply needs to be diluted or cut. That's what allows a larger quantity to be distributed much more easily and increasing the profit for the drug dealers.
So there still is a form of meth lab, just a less sophisticated operation going on.
The meth labs that we encounter today are what we refer to as conversion labs, and that's to address the smuggling method that is now being used to smuggle methamphetamine in a liquid form to avoid detection when it comes into the United States or when it's encountered on the highways coming through the United States. When it arrives at its destination, the methamphetamine in that liquid form has to be converted back to a solid form for retail distribution.
You mentioned the highways. It strikes me that to be a meth capital, Missouri seems very ill-situated for things coming in across borders. We're right in the middle of the country. It has to come a long way to get here.
It does. If you were to look at a map of the interstate system, though, we're at a crossroads. It's a common thoroughfare, a passover, so to speak, from Southern California, from Arizona, and from Texas. The interstate system that crosses Kansas and meets here in Kansas City makes it a ripe spot for interdiction.
You know, you mentioned being here at an earlier stage in your career and coming back here more recently. I wonder how it feels like it's different, this work now. Is it obviously the labs have changed, the quality of the drug has changed. How is your work as a law enforcement officer different now?
Well, in a couple of ways. First of all, technology has enabled drug traffickers to avoid detection, and we're always a step behind in keeping up with technology, especially as it relates to secure or encrypted communication. Another way that has changed, though, I think more importantly, is law enforcement's approach to what's often referred to as the war on drugs. We at the DEA now take very seriously a more three-pronged approach, where just as important as enforcement, which remains and needs to be unrelenting, is the education aspect in order to prevent use and addiction to begin with, and then the recovery and rehabilitation aspect, the more human side, the human toll that drug trafficking takes. We don't want to make felons out of victims. What we want to do is attack the people that capitalize on their weakness and their state of victimhood. That's what our goal is.
Well, one of the people who works on those other prongs of education and recovery in our community is Susan Whitmore, who works at First Calls, the president and CEO. Susan, it feels like every week on NPR or other sources, I hear another story about opioid addiction as the real problem these days, the overdoses, the misuse of prescription drugs. I hear a lot more about that, in fact, than I hear about meth. What's the reality for you on the ground here in Kansas City?
Well, the reality is we get more crisis calls for meth than we do for opioids, for sure.
Really?
And also more calls for alcohol use disorder. And I think the media's attention on the opioid epidemic is well founded in that opioids have the ability to kill people at much higher rates, and we're seeing the highest rate of death by overdose from opioids, for sure. Mm-hmm. Even though there are more people using methamphetamine, and overdose death can happen from meth. It's a central nervous system stimulant, so there can be cardiac events or stroke that result that end up with death, but it's not at the same rates as it is for opioids.
Yeah.
So, but we do have more people in need of treatment and recovery services related to meth than we do for opioids, at least in terms of people who are showing up on our doorstep.
And what are the consequences? Sure, if the death rate isn't as high as perhaps with some other drugs, still can have some potentially very serious consequences.
Absolutely. I mean, all substance use disorders have their origin in the brain, and it's a brain disorder that is exacerbated by high levels of use. And so what we see mostly with meth is co-occurring mental health issues, in extreme cases, psychosis, but certainly depressive and anxiety disorders accompany use of methamphetamine.
Some drugs are more addictive than others, to be sure. Where on the spectrum does meth fall?
Right up at the top.
And why is that?
Because it releases dopamine, which is the neurotransmitter associated with pleasure. We all experience normal levels of dopamine when we do things that we like. But both opioids and meth and other stimulants release massive amounts of dopamine that mess up our regulator as it pertains to dopamine. So after people get high, they experience a depletion of dopamine, and that drives them back to using again in order to just come back to baseline initially, but then also to induce a euphoric effect.
Alex Smith, in your reporting, do you have a sense of who the quote-unquote typical user of meth is in our area?
Well, from what I understand, I mean, it's now something that, you know, can be seen, you know, across demographic groups. I mean, I think for a long time, you know, meth was associated with, you know, smaller towns. I mean, I think, you know, like biker gangs, you know, were kind of notorious for you know, selling meth or smuggling meth.
Maybe lower income people in rural areas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, as I understand it, there's meth use, you know, just across groups.
I mean, Susan, let me ask you as well. I know you can't get into specific cases of people who come into First Call, but is there a general picture you can report?
Again, it's things have really changed, I think, both with heroin and meth, in that we're seeing it across all demographics. Many teenagers, for example, may be using Adderall or prescribed Adderall or misusing Adderall that belongs to friends of theirs. Teenagers may be experimenting with different prescription drugs they find. And people who start with stimulants may, if they become dependent and then can't get a prescription, they will turn to the street drug, which would be meth.
I'm curious, Eric Smith, you indicated that your office tries to apply a different approach to the to this issue than maybe it once did, and not pursue users as breaking the law so much, but directing them to education or recovery. How do you do that?
Well, it's very common for us in our daily work out on the streets to encounter users who need intervention. They are sources of information to us. They cooperate with us occasionally and provide us information on how to better target or better eliminate their sources of supply. But one thing that's important to us, and that's why I'm glad that Susan is here with us today, is we can partner with entities such as hers. First Call, we're on the street firsthand when we encounter the people who need recovery as opposed to incarceration. We can direct those resources.
And how does that partnering work? I mean, would there ever be a time where you actually take someone to the First Call offices and you pick them up and hand them over?
Likely not, although that would certainly be possible. It would be more a manner of us passing out the cards that First Call or other organizations that are similar would make available to us. Certainly, speak to family members or friends that are willing to advocate on their behalf to seek assistance.
Yeah. Susan, I guess it would be helpful to have some sense of what people encounter if they do get referred or reach out for help. But why don't I start by asking you, what's the number if there's anyone listening who either themselves is in crisis or knows someone who might be?
Sure. We have a 24/7 crisis call line, so you can call anytime. It's 816-361-5900, 816-361-5900.
You didn't even have to look at the card. You've given that a few times.
Yes, I have. And people will immediately be connected with a clinician who can help them if they're struggling with an addiction. About half of our calls also come from family members. So any concerned person is able to call that number and get information. Family members who are calling immediately get connected with a family counselor. We provide clinical services for both the family members and the person who's seeking recovery services.
And what do those clinical services look like for, let's start with a person who's seeking recovery? I mean, what is meth addiction treatment like?
Sure. Well, depending on where they're at when they call, we may direct them to the ER or a detox center immediately. But if they are able, they come in for an assessment. We do a clinical assessment to determine the severity of their addiction. And then from there, they either are directed into inpatient, either to a detox center, medical detox, and inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment, and that may be intensive outpatient or something not as intensive. And then some people also are able to go directly into a support group, which is a different type of therapeutic environment. But there's a continuum that happens for people. And so I would say for someone who has a severe addiction, what you're going to see is someone going from detox to treatment and then to aftercare and support services that will sustain them. I think a really important thing for people to realize is that most of our treatment centers are anywhere from 2 weeks to a month on average. And for most people, it's at least a 90-day period before acute withdrawal is over. And
right.
And depending on the drug, the brain chemistry doesn't return to normal for anywhere from 6 weeks to 3 months to 2 years.
Right.
For methamphetamine, it's a 2 to 3 year period where someone really needs sustained support. And this is why we see a lot of people returning to use after treatment or overdosing after treatment, because they've had a period of abstinence and then they go back to using their drug because they don't have adequate support. That is the really tricky place. And that's where we try to step in also with our recovery advocates, because we stick with people each step of the way.
Well, and I'm struck by, you mentioned obviously the role of families in this. It occurs to me that perhaps many people who are addicted to meth do not have the strongest set of influences around them to support mm-hmm. them after they begin or try to begin recovery.
Right, right. And in some cases, the substance use disorder has interrupted all those relationships. We think of it as a moral issue, but it's really a health issue for the person who has the disorder. And so we provide clinical services for family members to help them understand that cycle and what's going on there, and also how to take care of themselves as they navigate the recovery journey, because it really does involve the whole family.
I want to ask about, we jumped from law enforcement to kind of the recovery, but in between there's the idea of education and what mm-hmm. can be done in the community around that. I want to ask you, Alex, a little bit about programs that you became aware of as you reported on this story. Who's working on this issue?
Well, I think, again, because of the opioid crisis, you know, there has been a lot of attention being, you know, paid to opioids. I mean, on behalf of politicians and a lot of money going toward opioid recovery and treatment and everything. But, with meth, I mean, there's not that same necessarily focus or just level of awareness. But, you know, just across the board, you know, just about any program that offers, you know, treatment or help for opioids also does the same thing for meth. So, I mean, First Call, Rediscover, a lot of programs in Kansas City are helping with a lot of these issues.
Are there particular educational programs, and maybe you know about this too, Agent Smith, that actually try to reach people who maybe have not yet reached the point of addiction or who have not begun experimenting with meth?
Half of our staff are prevention specialists, and so we do prevention programming in the schools, and there are a number of evidence-based programs for kids from the elementary school level all the way up to high school that help with that and improve resiliency as it relates to both peer pressure and self-esteem and, you know, all those pieces.
We've moved beyond just say no.
Beyond just say no, yes. And that, which apparently we know from the evidence, doesn't work. The primary programs are life skills and students invest in success. And for elementary school children, there's a program called Conscious Discipline, which is a different way of the school environment interacting with children that helps build their self-esteem. And so you can't start prevention soon enough. It's really when kids are very young that they can start getting these messages.
Before we wrap this up, Eric Smith, I know there's a group of law enforcement agencies that works on this, the Midwest High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. What is that?
The Midwest HIDA is what we refer to it as, is a 7-state region based here in Kansas City. The HIDA program is a fiscal initiative based out of the White House, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and it's an initiative designed to financially support federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies to partner in the enforcement efforts.
And what are those enforcement efforts at this moment? What's sort of the cutting edge, the next steps for that group and that work?
Well, certainly the trait that needs to continue is partnership. The federal government can't do it alone. The state entities can't do it alone. And local agencies certainly can't do it alone. So as we partner with enforcement, we also want to broaden that view and partner with education specialists and recovery specialists.
Susan, remind us one more time of the number people can call if they need help or they know someone who does with meth or really with any other drug or alcohol addiction.
Absolutely. That's 816-361-5900.
And you can also find that on our Twitter feed at KCUR Up to Date. Susan Whitmore, President and CEO of First Call here in Kansas City. Eric Smith, the Assistant Special Agent in charge of the local DEA office. And Alex Smith, KCUR's health reporter. Thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll shift gears to talk about a different kind of treatment and care, the kind of home we might choose as we get older. Senior living, assisted living, skilled nursing, in-home care. What does it all mean? And what does it all cost? We'll sort out some of the options for housing in the future that awaits us all. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we heard why some think Kansas City should step back from major building projects and look at a neighborhoods first approach to development. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Steve will be back next week for a conversation with U.S. Representative Kevin Yoder, for an examination of that anonymous op-ed piece with the media critics, and a discussion with the director of Human Rights Watch. That's all next week on Up to Date. My grandmother is 110 years old. She lives in Washington State, and until about 10 years ago, she lived in her own house by herself without help. Not that she didn't have problems. She sometimes fell. She was mostly blind, and cooking was risky. But she wanted to be there. Eventually, in-home caregivers were hired to help out for parts of each day, and then she moved to a retirement community and assisted living where others made her meals. Now she's in a nursing home where there's still some communal activity, but she also spends more time in her bed. My grandmother had the means to make those moves and family nearby to help her make them. Not everyone has those resources, and even though she did, the choices were sometimes hard or confusing or full of second guesses. So today we're looking at the options out there for senior living. Joining us to talk through some of those questions and perhaps give us some answers on what people might want to consider even before they become seniors are Kevin Edwards, owner of Elder Care of Kansas City. They provide in-home care. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
And Jill Allen. She's with Village Shalom, a retirement community with several levels of care in Overland Park. Jill, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We also welcome your questions about senior living options. So give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888 with your own experiences or the things you want to know. I'm going to start with you, Kevin. You work with people who generally want to stay in their home, like my grandmother did, for a long time. Why do they want to do that?
Well, I think a lot of people want to stay in their home because it's familiar. The surroundings, they have their pictures on the wall and knickknacks, and they enjoy that comfort of being in a situation that they're familiar with, and they've lived in their house for years and years.
Right. Plus, moving is just really inconvenient.
It can be somewhat traumatic for some people.
Are there benefits to staying at home?
I think there are. I think that you can get all of the comforts and things that you're used to by having an in-home caregiver come in and assist with some of those things that you no longer can do yourself.
And of course, we should note that you run a business that provides care for people in that situation. There really are different levels of in-home care that you're talking about, right?
Yes, there are. One distinction to make, in-home care focuses on activities of daily living, such as transfers, walking, bathing, things of that nature, versus home health care, which is a medical service. A lot of people that come to us suffer from Alzheimer's or dementia. We have stroke patients. We have folks that are caring for an individual in their family, and they just need a break for 4 hours a day for a couple days a week. We also have hospice support services and post-inpatient care.
And you made this distinction between sort of daily activities, help with doing the stuff that everyone does around their house, versus actual home health care. But there are people who provide both of those kinds of services. Obviously.
There are, yes.
Is it sort of a buffet, a menu of choices people make? Can they have 2 hours of help or 4 hours of help or 24/7 help?
They can. We have some clients that we're there for 4 hours a day, one day a week, just so that the spouse or adult child who's the primary caregiver can get away and have lunch with a girlfriend or do whatever. We also care for people 24/7, and it's a little bit of everything in between. Each client is unique in their needs, and each family situation is different, so we have to meet the needs of the family and the client.
Yeah. I want to come back to some of those options and what those needs of the client might be, but I want to come to you, Jill. Obviously, Village Shalom is one of many options folks would have in the area for retirement living. In fact, it seems like there's more options all the time. There do seem to be, am I right about that, actually?
Correct.
Are there more and more choices?
Yes, there is a lot of choices in the Kansas City metro area.
Why so many?
I believe that there are a lot of opportunities in Kansas City for in-home care and then the retirement communities for the socialization purposes or the meals or the care. The community seems very open-minded to that type of living, and so that helps it to be successful. We have an aging population that is also allowing for that, too.
Are area communities at capacity as part of this building? Because do you have a waiting list?
We do have a waiting list in all areas of care. A lot of our competitors do also. Those wait lists vary in time frame from probably anywhere from a few days to many months. And so it's always good to plan ahead.
How far ahead? How long is that waiting list?
It's different for each individual person. I think as a senior, if I'm wanting to make my selections, I'm going to start talking to my adult children early so I can tell them what it is that's important to me that I'm looking for, make sure that I am going out and visiting places prior to when I need that, because if you wait for a crisis, they're going to be making those decisions for you versus you making them for yourself.
And I do want to talk about in a minute here what kinds of questions you should be asking or what you should be looking for when you make that visit. But first, give us a little bit of an overview, Jill. When we talk about the different levels of care, the continuum that's out there, what are those stages? It starts with what you might call independent living.
Correct. That is a great question because it is very different depending on what community you go visit. It might be that they have all levels of care on the campus where you have independent living that provides maybe maintenance and housekeeping, maybe a little bit of meal services. And then you move to, if you went in theory, the next step would be assisted living. And there are many different types of assisted living communities. You want to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. Mm-hmm. Some provide a very heavy level of care, where others, it might be just a step down from independent living. So it is very important to ask what amounts of care you can provide, what physical assistance you can get, medication assistance, that kind of thing. Then the next step would be the skilled nursing or skilled memory care or assisted living memory care.
How does a person decide then? I'm asking this of both of you. You where's that transition point between in-home care, maybe in-home, staying at home but getting some help, versus moving to a different place where there's a whole community of seniors living together and maybe sharing some common needs? How do you decide when to make that move? What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think it's different for each individual. Some people have a very strong desire to age in place, and if they have the financial means to do so, they may be under home care assistance for years and years until they pass. Others may not have that specific need or desire, and they may transition to a facility of some sort rather quickly.
Jill, similar question, similar answer?
I think ideally when someone starts that process, they come in and visit with someone at the communities, and you can talk about the different levels of care at each community. If they feel comfortable with a certain community and it feels like it would be a good fit for them, ideally then they're going to talk about the types of services you can get and how you determine when that is right, whether it's independent living or you wait till assisted living or skilled nursing, talk about wait lists. It's I think one of the key factors is consistency of the care. Also, so some people may be in their home with private duty caregivers that they're very comfortable with. They become like family, and they don't want to give up that relationship. Some communities are very open to that type of care coming in to help that person transition and make that transition easier into the retirement community, which is helpful. I think isolation and nutrition are sometimes big factors for people when their friends are getting older and not driving, so they don't have those socialization opportunities that they did, and the adult child is busy with children's programs and work.
Right.
So they may benefit from the socialization piece. Nutrition is definitely important, getting three well-balanced meals a day to help with the medications that they're taking and to not have reactions for those things. So it's different for everyone.
I want to invite our listeners too. What do you need to know about senior living options? Or maybe you've recently made a choice in this regard. What did you decide and why? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We're also on Twitter, if you are, at KCUR up to date. Tamara or Tamara in Kansas City, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is about the average median income requirements for a lot of these senior communities. In Jackson County, I haven't seen where they've been increased where they have in other counties, and so I have a difficulty trying to find some place to move to. Do you get any notifications about when those increases will occur?
Increases in the threshold for getting assistance to get into these communities?
No, they have a requirement, an income requirement for being accepted, and I'm just above the average median income. The only way I can move in is if I pay market rate, and I want to know, are they going to raise those minimums so that maybe I will qualify to move into a senior community?
I appreciate the question. I don't know if our guests have the knowledge to answer it, but let me ask them. Jill Allen, I don't think she's talking about a place like Village Shalom. She's talking about senior communities that are at least in part funded by social services.
I would guess that that's what she's asking also. And there are communities throughout the metropolitan area that have HUD requirements or sliding scale income, Medicaid certification. And I do not know what those limits are or if they're going to change.
I appreciate the question, though. Is it Tamara or Tamara?
Yes.
Okay, Tamara. I appreciate your question. Maybe we can try to get you some information about that. But I appreciate your reminding us that there are other senior housing options out there for folks in different situations. Thank you.
I would recommend reaching out to one of the local agencies that Jackson County or the Social Rehabilitation Services to see if they can get those answers.
Well, and I think Tamara's question actually raises another issue, which is the issue of money. I know there is an almost impossible number of variables to consider. You've both talked about the range of options that's out there, so this is a very hard question to ask. But is it fair to say we're talking about some potentially pretty expensive choices people are making that if they've planned ahead are affordable, and if they haven't planned ahead may not be so affordable?
That's right. For home care, the average rate per hour in Kansas City, according to the most recent Genworth study — Genworth is an insurance conglomerate that does a study of home care as well as other facility type rates — $22 an hour is the typical average rate in Kansas City right now for home care.
Which may seem reasonable for the kind of help being provided, but at the same time can really add up.
That's right. It can add up, especially if you're talking about care that's needed every day of the week, 24/7 care, obviously.
Jill, what's the entry point for somewhere like Village Shalom? And of course, there's others throughout the area.
Correct. Most of the communities, there are good opportunities for people of all levels of wealth in the Kansas City market. A lot of the CCRCs, or continuing care retirement communities, like Village Shalom, are faith-based. And so the majority of them have some sort of resident assistance program, should you deplete your resources, or are Medicaid certified. So once you're financially qualified to join that community or taken on as a resident at that community, you're never asked to leave for financial reasons.
And is that, when you say financially qualified, is there an assumption that a person who decides to live in one of these communities probably will live there the rest of their lives if they want to? That means they're going to sell their existing house?
Correct. Unless you're there for short-term rehabilitation. If you've been in the hospital and you just need a little bit of recoup time, maybe some physical or occupational therapy, speech therapy, before you return to your home. But generally, if you're joining a continuing care retirement community like Village Shalom or others in the market, you are coming in at independent living or assisted living, and you have sold your home or are renting it to someone.
But I think a lot of people worry that they will run out of money. They will sell their house, they will make a couple hundred thousand dollars in that, and then they'll pay a few thousand dollars a month, but they might outlive their money. You're saying, Jill, that maybe they don't need to worry about that quite as much.
Some communities, and that's one of the questions you need to find out up front, if they have a benevolent fund or if they are Kansas or Missouri Medicaid certified. In our case, we are. And so, therefore, if you deplete your resources, then you are never asked to leave the campus for financial reasons.
And Kevin, for folks who are deciding to stay in their home and try to take advantage of services that come to them there, they don't have that asset available to them of the value of their home. So what do they do?
Well, there are Medicaid-certified home care agencies, both in the state of Kansas and the state of Missouri. We've chosen not to be in that segment of the business, but those opportunities are out there for people that are in that situation.
Go ahead, Jill.
I was going to say, and some people have long-term care insurance policies, and those can be utilized in a retirement community, or some have policies that do have home care coverage. And so it's very important to review that policy with someone or call in and ask the questions to make sure that you are utilizing your benefits to the maximum.
Let's talk to some of our callers at 816-235-2888. Linda in Shawnee, welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning. Thank you.
What's your question for our guests?
It's not a question, sir. It's a comment, because we were downsizing in Lenexa Shawnee area, and some of the communities that we looked at were wonderful. The problem that I had personally is that you have to buy their food plans, and I prefer to cook organic, and you must buy into their food plans. And when we talked with them 2 years ago, there was at least a stepped up plan. You could buy so many meals, but I understand that is no longer offered, and you have to buy all the food, even if you choose not to eat it. And that was a stopper for us. We also like to garden. And although you cannot garden in your personal space, they do have I think 10 by 4 by 10 places where you can garden, and that was a real plus for us. But the food was a showstopper for now.
Hang on, Linda. Let me ask Jill Allen about that. I know you don't speak for every retirement community in the area, Jill, but is that common that the 3 meals a day are included in the cost?
I've seen that it varies depending on each community. And again, that's one of those questions that you want to make sure up front when you're visiting different communities, that you're comparing apples to apples. Some retirement communities provide 1 meal a day in their independent living. Some provide 3. And so it just depends on each location.
Linda brought up something else, which involves a sacrifice I think people may have a hard time making when choosing to leave their own home, which is things like gardening, getting space to call your own beyond your own apartment.
Correct. You know, I think, again, many of the communities in the Kansas City market are doing a great job of understanding what residents or future residents desires are, what their interests are, and coming up with ways to accommodate that by gardening, by a tool shop, by different crafts, painting galleries, that kind of thing, so that it helps them to not feel like they're giving up what they had in their home.
Linda, I hope that at least answers some of your questions.
May I add one more positive thing is that a lot of people, we have several friends who have moved and they get rid of everything. And when you get there, you can donate it down to the store, and they even buy back your own stuff. But the proceeds from the little store helps fund the people who live there a long time and perhaps run out of money. That's a nice thing.
That is a nice thing. Thanks for sharing that, Linda. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Nick. Bye-bye.
Take care. You know, I do think it's worth mentioning, Jill, that a lot of folks might be surprised at the amenities that some of these retirement communities offered. I don't mean to be flippant when I say this, but when I have visited folks who live in these communities, I think, how old do I have to be to move here?
I hear that a lot from the adult children. Yeah. They're often, the parents are dragging their feet, not ready, but the adult child says, where can I sign up and when?
Theaters, ice cream shops.
Absolutely. Happy hour, driving ranges, putting greens, all different kinds of things. Dog runs. It's great.
Happy hour got a lot of positive attention around here in the studio. Kevin, I do want to ask the same question of you. Are there ways that folks can, obviously a person staying in their home just because they're at home doesn't mean they are able to garden the way they used to or take advantage of things. How do the services that are available for elder care allow people to continue activities that maybe they wouldn't be able to do on their own?
They can continue those kinds of activities. We have some people, one client of ours who we work with 3 days a week for 4 hours a day. And on Mondays, he and the caregiver typically go out to lunch. And then on Friday, they travel to the Ward Parkway shopping center, go to Starbucks, and he gets a coffee and they people watch. And that is, for him, socialization. He gets out. He sees some of his friends sometimes. So it's what he enjoys. We have other people who get together with some of their friends and the caregivers. So those kinds of activities are available.
Let's talk to David in Kansas City. And David, I understand that you've been on this journey. You've had to make some of these choices.
Yes, my wife died a long time ago. I got sick 2 years ago. I spent over a year between St. Luke's Hospital and Bishop Spencer Rehab Center. I'm now in Brookdale Senior Living Center in, on Warnell Road, and I've been here for 4 months.
And how did you navigate those moves from place to place as your circumstances required them? Did you have to do all that on your own?
Not at all. I've had social workers at St. Luke's and Bishop Spencer, and now I've got a person that was at Brookdale that said that he felt I was too good to be in assisted living, and now I'm in independent living. And I do for myself. I've got 3 meals a day access, and I've got I've got a kitchen with microwave.
So you can do some of your own cooking.
I can do all my own cooking if I want to. I've got a washer and dryer that I can go down the hallway too, so I can take care of myself completely here.
Have you been satisfied with the choices that you've made or the help you've received?
very satisfied. And on gardening, there's a garden about 100 feet away from me and that I can garden, and I've got a balcony that I've got bamboo and herbs planted on.
Well, David, I really appreciate you calling in. It's a good reminder, first, that people sometimes move the other direction in the continuum from assisted care back to independent living. And also, it's just good to hear your positive experience. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I hope everyone has a good day. Thank you.
Thanks, David. We hope you do, too. Very quickly, I want to touch on something. Jill, you mentioned that a lot of retirement communities are faith-based, including Village Shalom, but that doesn't necessarily mean only people who share that faith can go there, right?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. At Village Shalom, we're about 60% Jewish, 40% not. As far as I know, every faith-based community in the Kansas City area is not only to that faith.
Right. I think Bishop Spencer Place,
absolutely,
John Knox Village, they all have religious affiliations, but they but
Lakeview
they are
Village,
open to others.
Aberdeen Village, yes.
Right. We had a listener who emailed us, we're almost out of time, but the listener says, some institutions require you pay them $100,000 or more to get in, while others are rentals where the rent may increase. What's the flexibility in getting in or out of those institutions? Jill, is it possible to give a general answer to that question?
Yes. That listener is correct that there are rental opportunities. Generally, they are a freestanding independent living where you have maybe assisted living, but maybe not skilled nursing or different levels of care. And that is a month-to-month rental. It's generally a little higher because you're not putting that lump sum up front.
Right.
Most of the continuing care retirement communities do have the entrance fee, but most are a 90% refundable where you get 90% of that entrance fee back. But again, that is a very important question to ask up front and maybe even get a copy of the contract to make sure what type of contract that is.
So again, important to think about what you need and know what questions to ask going in. I wish we had more time to talk more about this. Jill Allen at Village Shalom, Kevin Edwards of Elder Care of Kansas City, thank you both for taking this time to at least help us start the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yesterday, we looked at the state of abortion rights in Kansas and Missouri and what impact Brett Kavanaugh's appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court could have. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Also, find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Steve Kraske's back Monday for a look at how the events of 9/11 are being taught to students who weren't alive in 2001. Join us for that. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.